Good morning, everyone. Welcome to New Life. If you're new with us, my name is Mark Lohman, and I'm the associate pastor here. So we just had a big holiday 3 days ago, Thanksgiving. If you were like me, it wasn't at your house this year. Well, it hasn't been at my house any year so far. So we were driving, and we had the lucky privilege of sitting on the lovely 91 and 5 freeway. It's always a joy around the holidays. So I thought I would take us down a trip down memory lane that I think at some point most of us have probably been through. I want you to imagine, to think through, to visualize as you're sitting there, that very first time that you brought your spouse, or if you're not married, your best friend, a boyfriend, a girlfriend that you're dating at the time, to meet your family for the first time at a big Thanksgiving, Christmas, or Easter meal. Got it? And more particularly, on the car ride over there, what were you talking about? What was the conversation like? I would suspect that it probably went something like this. Okay, honey, whatever you do, don't say anything about my sister having a tattoo. Everyone will freak out. Oh, and my grandma. Okay, don't take it personal at all. She's probably going to make some really snarky comments to you. Just brush it aside. Oh, cousin Johnny, by the way. Okay, he's probably going to drink too much. He does it every year. It's normal. Everything's going to be okay. Just trust me. Oh, okay, and Aunt Sally, she always tells embarrassing stories of me. She's probably going to tell you that one time, 10 years ago, Thanksgiving dinner, I had horrible diarrhea. And lastly, probably when it's all said and done, we're tired, we're ready to go, my mom's probably going to want to take 35 pictures of the entire family, and it's going to take 35 minutes to do it because she's using a digital camera that she doesn't know how to use. Okay, now only one of those things is true of me and my family that I just said. I'll let you figure out which one of those it is. But I think we've all been in that situation before, right? I mean, you're introducing your best friend, your spouse, whoever it is, to your family, and like you're in the car ride, and you gotta prepare them for all the awkward, crazy, weird stuff that's gonna happen in your family. It's an act of preparation. You're preparing them so they're not blindsided by all the weird stuff that's gonna happen. And in some ways, I think for this morning, what we're gonna look at, Advent means preparation. It literally means coming. It means expectant waiting. And so, as Juno said, this for the next month, literally the whole entire globe for Christians, we are entering the season of Advent, the Christmas season, the birth of Jesus, right? The first and the original Christmas story. And I think for us, as Americans, we think of the Christmas story as kind of, you know, snow falling, ham, big presents, hot cocoa, maybe Mariah Carey playing in the background. If you know what song I'm talking about, I love that song and I'm unashamed to say it. But the true Christmas story, it was political, it was messy, and it was scandalous. And furthermore, it was this huge dramatic plot with a slew of characters. It's a story, what any good story is. And so for this next month for Advent, as you can tell with the graphic there on your program too, we're going to look at the Christmas story as a story, because it is that. And it's the greatest story ever told. And so we're going to look at it through the lens of the different characters involved. So next Sunday, we're going to look at the birth of Jesus through the lens of Mary, and then Joseph, then the wise men, and then Christmas Eve will climax with the shepherds and the angels. But before we do that, I think we need to do a little family preparation, just like we do on the car ride over to meet our family for the first time on Thanksgiving, Christmas, or Easter. If we don't do that, we're not going to understand. We're going to be blindsided by some things. They're going to take us aback. And so we're going to look at Jesus' family this morning. Its history, its heritage, what Matthew calls it for us, his genealogy. And so we're going to open up. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, literally like the very first words of the New Testament. And I'll read it out loud for us as we usually do, and I would encourage you to follow along with me. We'll have it on the TV screens. use your iPhone. We have these free Bibles that are available to you underneath the chairs in front of you. If you're using those, I'll be reading from them on page 675. Okay, everyone there. Someone tell me what you see in this passage. You can talk out loud. You just see a bunch of the father of, right? Okay, we're a little awake this morning. Let's wake up. If you came this morning to look at a Jewish phone book, you're in the right place, because this is what we're reading this morning. Fasten your seatbelt. Here we go. Matthew 1, verse 1. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Abinadab. Abinadab, the father of Nahshon. By the way, guys, quick tip. I have no idea how to pronounce these names. The trick is you read them quick, you act like you know how to say them, and everyone thinks you know how to say them. Okay, Nahshon, the father of Sam, and Sam, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. We are one third of the way through. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Another quick tip, if you're pregnant here, you're expecting a child, can't figure out a name, here's some suggestions for you. As the father, Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. That's awesome. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Amon. And Amon, the father of Josiah. Josiah, the father of Jeconiah, his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. Two-thirds of the way through, we're almost there. After the exile to Babylon, we have Jeconiah as the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim, the father of Elihud. Elihud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathon. Mathon, the father of Jacob. And finally, most of us will probably know this, Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who's called the Messiah. Thus, there were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. Okay, fair to say, the original Christmas story does not start off with, you know, the typical Hallmark cliche, warm, sappy, you know, once upon a time, or 'twas the night before Christmas and all through the house. No. Instead, it starts off with like 46 names, I think, that all sound like they come out of like the Star Wars trilogy or something, okay? We skip this. Obviously, right? You were probably a little annoyed that I just read through 46 names for 3 or 4 minutes. So is Matthew, this Jewish tax collector, why does he start off the Christmas story, much less the New Testament, with a bunch of names that are dull, boring, and we don't understand them? What's going on here? Matthew, he's preparing, remember that word, preparing, his Jewish audience to see and meet the most scandalous birth of all. Matthew is taking us in a car ride to meet the family for the first time, and he's saying, there's some weird people here, it's gonna be awkward, and I'm gonna tell you this ahead of time, because otherwise you're gonna be completely blindsided by it. But he says, hey, you know what, it's gonna make sense. To hang with me, look at all these names. I promise you, in the end, it's going to be good. See, in the ancient Jewish culture, your genealogy, your family history, it was your resume. It signified your rank, your title, your power. Some of you may not know this, but it's kind of like the phrase saying, oh, who's your daddy? That was a phrase I said a lot in the 90s. You played sports. If you slam dunked on someone, you hit a home run off someone, you'd be like, dude, who's your daddy? I own you. Literally, for the Jewish people, it really was, who's your daddy? Because in that culture, unfortunately, females were treated inferior. Not a good thing. Humanity is broken. And so in their genealogies, it was a list of all male names. And that signified your heritage, your history, your ancestry. What's shocking here is that Matthew includes some names that don't belong on the genealogy, so to speak. He gives five names that are no bueno. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to go through every single name, so don't worry about that. I'm just going to highlight a couple. But what's fascinating here is that Luke, another author of a book that gives us the birth of Jesus, Luke has a genealogy of Jesus too. What does Luke do? Luke has 76 names, even more, all male. Matthew includes five females. So you think the introduction of your family would be a little overwhelming at Thanksgiving or Christmas? Check this out. Okay, first of these five, verse 3, Tamar. Crazy thing about Tamar. Tamar tricked her father-in-law into thinking that she's a temple prostitute and then sleeps with him. That's called incest, if you don't know. In the Old Testament, incest, you were stoned for it. Tamar, not only does she commit incest with her father-in-law, but she's not Jewish. She's a Gentile. She's a foreigner. She's outside of the bounds of the Jewish culture, which was a big deal back then. It's a big no-no. Don't do it. Second family in Jesus' history here, second female, Rahab. Verse 5. Rahab, throughout the entire Bible, is known really for two things and really one thing. She's a Gentile prostitute. And she happens to help Israel defeat the city of Jericho in the Old Testament because she hides two of their spies. But again, a prostitute and a Gentile. Female number 3, mentioned also in verse 5, Ruth. Ruth wasn't Jewish either. She was a Moabite. In the, Judy, I saw you a mouth Moabite. Good job. You know your history. That's impressive. I totally just put you on the spot. That's a compliment, though. That's awesome. I didn't know that before I read this. Okay, so she's a Moabite. Now, in the Old Testament, the Moabites were not allowed into God's sanctuary, even to the 10th generation. No bueno. She is in the royal genealogy of Jesus. Fourth female on the list. Matthew must not really like this lady because he doesn't even give us her name. But we know her as Bathsheba. Bathsheba is mentioned in verse 6, except she's mentioned as the wife of Uriah. Well, what does Bathsheba do? Well, there's this guy named King David that we'll talk about, and she has an affair with him. Lovely. Okay, here's the other crazy thing. Not only does she have an affair with King David, but she's married to a non-Jewish person called Uriah. He's a Hittite. Not a hitchhike, by the way. I said that word to Rachel the other day, and she said, did you just say hitchhike? No. So, sticky situation too, to say the least. So, verses 3, 5, and 6, you have four women, all kind of moral, gender, and cultural outsiders, all in scandal. They prepare the way for the fifth female in this genealogy. You probably know her. Verse 16, Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who's called the Messiah. See, these women are preparing the reader, the kind of, Matthew's giving you a heads up saying, this little peasant girl, probably 12, 13, 14 years old, is going to give birth to the Messiah, God's son. And she's going to do it in the most scandalous, sketchy way because she's going to be an unwed mother. Huge no-no in that culture. So all were outsiders. Many of them were encased in scandal. Yet all of them were chosen by God to play an essential part and the greatest story ever told. The Bible doesn't begin the original Christmas story with poinsettias, beautiful church choir, bunch of holy people, once upon a time. No, it does the opposite. See, Jesus' genealogy, his family history, it reads the way an awkward family photo looks. And Matthew is giving us clues for the type of people that Jesus came to save. And so when you hear some of these stories, do you see yourself in them? Right? Do you feel guilty over something? I don't know. Maybe you are an adulterer, a murderer. Maybe you have committed incest. I don't want to know that probably, but hey, whatever. The point is there something in your life that you feel terrible about, that you have done, something you said or done that you entirely regret, that you can't get behind, and you know it, and you're like, I can't excuse it, I can't ignore it, I can't justify it, but man, am I jacked up. The genealogy of Jesus says there's room for you in the Christmas story. The Christmas story is for people who feel that way. Jesus came to save sinners. It's all grace. I love Mark Driscoll. He's a well-known pastor. I love kind of what he says next about the flow of this passage. He says, now how many of you in reading this react the same way that the recipients who heard this first reacted? Meaning you're probably religious, moral, spiritual, self-righteous, and proud. You say, I'm so glad I'm not like that. I'm so glad my family history is not like that because we didn't do those things. Two things for you. Number one, you're probably more messed up than you know. Number two, your pride is a sin that's at least equal to adultery, murder, and incest. Pride is a horrendous sin, actually, because pride says, I don't need the grace of God because the grace of God is for sinners, and I don't need the grace of God because I'm not a sinner. When pride is actually your very sin. And that tends to be the preferred sin of religious, moral, righteous, holy people as we judge others and we overlook our own hypocrisy. See, even the supposed holy and heroic people in this genealogy, the main two being David and Abraham, they're mentioned in verse 1. We'll get back to that verse. They're full of imperfections. So take Abraham, right? Magnificent figure in the scriptures. He's smack dab in the 11th and 12th chapter of the entire Bible. Abraham's told, dude, through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. That's a big deal. I mean, pretty heroic, big, monumental, towering figure. The interesting thing is that the Bible also goes out of its way to tell the whole story of Abraham, and he's just as jacked up and broken and in desperate need of the grace of God and a Savior. Abraham was a lost pagan Babylonian before he got to know God, and he tried to give his wife away twice. David, King David, towering, monumental figure, right? King David, a man after God's own heart, the man who's told that through you, a king will go, a king will rule the entire earth with peace, justice, and righteousness. King David, who writes worship songs in the Psalms. King David, little shepherd boy who slays a big giant. King David, who's supposed to build the temple of God, murderer and adulterer. Right? We're hinted at that little story in verse 6 with Bathsheba. Bathsheba, he had an affair with her. He killed her husband. When he was a warrior in his own, my mind's going blank here, army, yes. Just killed him. You messed up my life. I don't need you. See, with this list, Matthew, he's giving us clues about the kind of people Jesus came to save. Men and women, saint and sinner, prostitute and virgin, Jewish and Gentile. This genealogy, it's comprehensive of humanity. And we can look at all the stories of these men and women and see a little reflection of ourselves. The good news is that in verse 1, Matthew says that Jesus is the son of David, the son of Abraham. So David, King David, who's told that a king will come from you to rule with peace, justice, righteousness, hope, and joy. What all the other kings kind of foreshadowed, Jesus is that king. Abraham, through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Jesus is the person who does that. He gives grace to everyone, fulfilling what God told Abraham thousands of years ago in Genesis 12, through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Simply put, Jesus is the king coming to save everyone who calls upon him. Matthew, for his Jewish audience, is preparing them to meet their Messiah, but a Messiah for everyone. See, the beginning of the original, the first Christmas story, it's messy, it's awkward, it's sketchy, maybe you feel a little weird right now, right? It includes the people that you tell your spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, or best friend about as you're going to go meet them for the first time. Watch out for this person, they're weird and crazy. But it ends up, it finishes even better than the best Hallmark Christmas story. Did you wonder why this genealogy in verse 17 ends the way it does? What's up with this number 14? Verse 17, Jake, can you put it back up on the slides, please? Verse 17 says this: there were 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. What's going on here? Why the number 14? Is 14 like Matthew's, you know, baseball number from high school, and so he just wants to keep on using it? I do that with my passwords and stuff. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. So why does Matthew, this rugged tax collector, include, why does he group the genealogy into three sections of 14? Now, scholars have a field day with this. I think there's 8 theories put out there as to what's going on. Okay, whatever. One of the theories put forth is that what Matthew's doing here is that he doesn't want Jesus to just be another son in this genealogy. But he's saying that he's actually the goal of the whole list. And so he arranges this genealogy into three groups of 14, or perhaps we should say 6 groups of 7. I want you to track me. 3 groups of 14, divide 14 in half, you get 7. Multiply it times 2. I don't like math either. So perhaps what he's doing is 3 groups of 7. Now the number 7, track with me here, I know it gets kind of crazy. The number 7 is the most symbolic and powerful number in the entire Bible. And to be born at the beginning of the 7th 7 would be the climax to the whole list. Matthew is saying, this Christmas story, the first one, the original one, is what Israel and the whole world has been waiting for. The famous Christmas song, O Little Town of Bethlehem. I love that little line, right? It says, the hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. See, the number 7, it signifies perfection, totality, completion. That's why God rested on the 7th day. The Sabbath, the day of rest, it occurs on the 7th day, the end of the week when everything is finished and completed, and we are to rest in, to remember that God rules and is in control and is putting this whole world to rights. He's ushering in his saving reign. The kingdom of God is making its way forward. And the birth of Jesus. What's going on here? The Christmas story, the birth of Jesus, is the beginning of the eternal Sabbath. Perfection, totality, completion. The Christmas story is about perfection coming out of imperfection. The little Jewish baby boy came from a long line of an imperfect family, but he's here to bring perfection. See, our modern mythic Christmas stories, they don't deal with imperfection. Please let me know if the next month, if you see any Christmas movies that include prostitutes, incest, maybe adultery, but probably not the first two, or murder. The first Christmas story, it recognizes the reality of imperfection. But it also says, hey, you know those magical endings? Snowfall, once upon a time endings. The Christmas story is nothing short of a perfect Christmas. See, where do you find yourself this morning? Where does your story fit in this genealogy, right? A lot of us come from broken families, failed friendships, and Christmas revisits a lot of those problems and issues. Pain, grief, maybe nostalgia. We are all in so many different ways. We're going to experience some pretty messy, maybe awkward dynamics moments here in the next month as we enter Christmas. And we, of course, we could take the usual car ride where we expect and prepare for the messy things, the weird dynamics with our family, with our friends this Christmas season, kind of like the way I started off, right? That's how we typically do Advent. But what if we took the route of Jesus' genealogy this year as we prepare and wait for the Christmas season? And instead of being overwhelmed with all the brokenness and messiness of life, instead, we're overwhelmed with the sheer grace that the King baby boy brings. As one scholar put it, if God can work through these bizarre 2,000 years ago in Jesus' birth, he seems to be saying, watch what he's going to do now. See, no one is outside the bounds of the grace of God. Prostitute, virgin, Gentile, Jewish, male, female, saint, and sinner. Everyone is in Jesus' genealogy. And so for your drunk or drug-addicted uncle, the birth of the Messiah, it brings the possibility of freedom, of hope, of ultimate recovery. For the wounds of divorce in your family, the birth of the Messiah brings the possibility of comfort, of love, of restoration, right? For that prodigal cousin, rebellious friend of yours, whoever, ran from God last 2 to 4 years, no contact with anyone. The birth of the Messiah lays open the possibility and says, you are welcome home whenever with open arms. And for your depressed or lonely aunt, the birth of the Messiah lays open the possibility of hope, of joy, of a bright future. See, most of us wouldn't have started the Christmas story with a mundane, dull genealogy. That's boring and stupid. It's an untold beginning. We skip over it. Who cares? Right? Who in their right mind would think that the first words of the New Testament are this? But then again, Who would dream of? Who would imagine our lives are one giant story of imperfection shining light on his perfection? See, ultimately, the Bible, the Christmas story, yeah, it's got a messy, awkward beginning, but it ends with a miracle. So we're going to invite the music team back up right now. They're going to sing a couple songs for us to lead us in worship. We want to respond this morning to what God is doing. We aren't a people who come here just to hear things and then leave out the doors unchanged. If lives aren't changed, so what? Right? The gospel matters. It changes lives. And so there's so many ways to respond this morning. The ushers will come forward here in a minute or two to collect our offering. If New Life is your home, this is one of the ways for you to respond, right? To give thanks to God for his grace and to say, you know what, money is not in control of me. And so they'll do that. We also have communion here, right? So it's the grace of God to participate in the bread and the juice, remind you that Jesus died on the cross for you, and no matter what you've done, it's all grace because of the cross. Candles, you can light a candle to symbolize. Are you in a messy, dark situation this year as you enter Christmas? There's hope because of Jesus. All right, we have a prayer team who would love to pray with you in the back for anything. Anything's fair game. And or you can just sit there and stand, do, you know, listen to this music, participate in worship the King. So I'm going to invite the ushers forward at this point to collect their offering. Let's respond as a community.